The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Hello there and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of the best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so this week, Green Party councillor Hazel Chu came in to highlight the rampant but often covert racism in Irish society. She came to recount her personal experience of it and to encourage people to speak out whenever they encounter it. We all hide certain things when we're getting to know a potential love interest, but what if that thing is a terminal illness? This is Sinead Carroll's dilemma. Be upfront about her brain tumour or keep it secret. Well, she talked with me about her quest for love and the quandary she's in. Everyone's favourite vet, Noel Fitzpatrick, is back. Channel 4 showed a special series of Animal Rescue Live all this week. And friend of the show, Noel, spoke to me about opening your heart, but not your mouth in case of germs, to rescue animals. And Chris Donovan suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of scenes he witnessed when serving with the Irish Defence Forces. An honest, brave and honourable man, he shared his story with me. That's it for this week. I hope you enjoy it. Until the next time. Thanks for listening. At 9:26, Hazel Chu, I should say a Green Party councillor, Hazel Chu, good morning to you.
Good morning. Hazel Chu's just fine.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Because last time we met and spoke, it was in November. It was the run-up to the elections. You were a guest of ours and you gave us a great detail and story about your background and who you are and where you're from. So congratulations on getting elected.
Thank you.
I suppose a little recap briefly as to your background and how you ended up on our show and chatting to us about your parents and their amazing story. Mm-hmm. They had ended up on a restaurant in O'Connell Street, isn't that right?
They did. So when I was here in November, it was after I wrote a piece for the Journal.
And
I got a bit of backlash in terms of talking about racism in Ireland. And part of it was talking about my parents' background story. They emigrated here in the 70s and they both met over here, and somehow they met while both working in a Chinese restaurant off O'Connell Street, which is now closed, unfortunately. It's now McDonald's. So, but their story started from here.
Yes.
So.
And they met and started a family, and they got into, there was a kind of a street side food initially that turned into restaurants, isn't that right?
Yes. There was a chip van, as I was saying at the time. It was very Roddy Doyle. there was a chip van, and they worked very hard. They were working two jobs at one stage to save up for the chip van, and then they ended up moving to Maynooth to get a takeaway, and we moved to Selbridge. And during all that time, unfortunately during the chip van, there were a couple of incidences, so that kind of made my mum want to move. And but it was a lovely place to live still.
Yeah.
So Ireland was at the time and still is a great place to live. So.
You were born in what hospital?
Rotunda.
And you were reared in what part of Dublin?
Fir House. So
okay.
Born and raised in Fir House. I did move to Selbridge, so I am a Lily White girl. But so Dublin all my life, and then, Dublin and Kildare all my life.
Okay. I was in two minds as to the wisdom of us having this conversation this morning. I'm sure you were in two minds yourself.
I was. So, and I think the thing is, these things need to be said. So, and I think we need to talk about it.
So what happened last week?
So what happened last week is that someone sent me a video on Twitter and referred me to a link, a few people actually. And what had happened was there was an individual standing outside a protest in Dublin. I was at Google in Dublin at the time, and I was referred to as that migrant, and that I was curtailing people's freedoms and trying to censor people by saying that hate speech is wrong. Now, I stand by what I say, hate speech is wrong. So I'm not that migrant, born, as we were just saying, in the Rotunda and grew up in Ireland. But then it kind of grew from there. Somehow everyone felt like they had a right to discuss whether I was Irish or not from that point.
Okay, let's park it for a moment and say that you referred to this clip of somebody outside at a protest, a freedom of speech protest outside Google, saying that you are that migrant, Hazel Chu. You're not a migrant.
No.
And even if you were,
I checked, no.
Even if you were, when did that become a slur?
Exactly.
Let's ask that question. But when you watched it, where did you watch it?
I watched it at home. So
where were you at home?
I was in my sitting room at home, actually, watching it.
On a laptop?
On a laptop, yeah.
Okay, and describe to me what you thought when you saw the protester saying that about you.
I thought, well, if we are going to have conversations and discussions, then we need to bring facts to the table. And it was factually incorrect. So I'm all for, I've had a lot this week, Ryan, in terms of people telling me what I can and can't say. And part of the problem is, and the other argument is, oh, you're trying to censor us. But this conversation isn't about censorship. When you talk about people, when you have discussions, the debates, you need to be factual. They need to be true. We need to stop spreading lies and misinformation. So I'm a big fan of John Stuart Mill's, and I had a lecturer in UCD, John Baker, who was amazing, equality lecturer. And one of the things Mill's is all about is about liberty, and that your liberty should be protected. But he himself also stated that if harm was going to be involved, if anyone's protection of liberty causes another person's harm, then surely we need to look into it. And what is happening on streets right now, certain streets right now, is that people, there is speech that's causing people harm. Questioning one's sexual orientation, saying that they shouldn't be existing, is harmful. Questioning whether one is superior race than another is harmful. So, and saying that, and having people discuss debates, stating that it's a debate, but starting off on the foot that that particular person has less rights for you than you, doesn't mean it's a fair debate to begin with.
What did you write in response to the clip calling you that migrant?
My response was my usual kind of sarky response. In fairness, I am quite sarcastic sometimes. And it was very much, well, listen, if we're talking about me being a migrant, I was born in Rotunda, I was raised in Dublin, and, well, I am a representative of everyone. So, and I do protect, and I am against hate speech, if that's what I think I said. So, so, and that was it. That was the tweet. And somehow the feedback I got then was, well, you're not Irish, so you don't belong here. You shouldn't have a right to discuss and tell us what to do. And it kind of spiraled because someone then tagged someone overseas. And this is a problem I have as well, that it becomes this kind of
global
thing that for a lot of people who said, oh, you're a foreigner and you're not Irish and you shouldn't have a right to police our thoughts here. The fact that they then tag people overseas who also, well, in their mind, probably wouldn't be Irish, judging by their standards, to come into the debate was just slightly ironic as well. So someone with a lot of followers, with about half a million followers, then tagged me in, and he is quite well known for his right-wing views. And next thing you know, I was receiving hundreds of messages discussing whether I should be sent back to my own country, asking what will happen if people did this in China. Why do I not advocate for mass immigration in China? Again, never advocated for mass immigration in the first place. So, and that I had no right to be here, and that I should respect the country that has given me a home, or given me free housing was another one. So, and then a petition started to say that I was racist. So I was racist.
You're racist.
Yeah, I'm a racist apparently.
Who are you racist towards?
Apparently I was racist towards Irish people.
Okay.
So
how? I'm just trying to get a little bit of logic there. What was the
claim? Now, I read the petition a few times myself, and oh God, it was just a bit incoherent altogether.
Hardly a shock.
It was, it was a bit incoherent altogether. But I think the basis of it was saying that I was racist towards Irish people because I was belittling them, and that I was telling them what to do, and it went on from there. And it did. Fortunately, there was only I think, about 50 signatures to this petition that had gone up for a week. It actually started before this, apparently. The start date was a week ago. So, but I found the whole thing a bit baffling because suddenly I was the racist and suddenly I was told, well, I don't belong here, even though I was born and grew up here, and that there would be all sorts of repercussions and that there was displacement of the Irish identity thanks to me, and that there a recalibration was coming.
Really?
And when you look
this
at
is
those,
the language of the of white supremacy. This is Charlottesville. No, it is. This is what we've been seeing in the last few years. Let's say 2016 onwards, for obvious reasons. The comment that someone put down that you were either Irish or Chinese, pick one, lady. That sort of kind of cavalier racism that that seems to be part and parcel of what you have to contend with. So you read all these things, and you think what?
I think...
Do you think that they're mad? Or do you think that they're angry? Or do you think that they have a right to say what they have to say?
I think that we have a huge problem in the country. That we have 10,000 homeless. We have still an economy that is against the working class. We have issues when it comes to healthcare, and people want something to blame. And somehow it's easier to blame immigration. It's easier to blame... people within the LGBTQ community. It's easier to blame people who are different. So, and people hold on to that. It is a case that, because at the end of the day, whenever I did go back on Twitter to have a reasoned debate, talk about this dog whistle of mass immigration and ask for facts, people didn't come back with facts. They came back with rhetoric. And the thing is, if you're going to use a word like mass immigration, then tell me how the CSO figures are incorrect. Tell me how suddenly when in 2018, we had 90,000 immigrants, and out of that, 31%, which is just under 30,000, were Irish people returning. How is that mass? That is less than 1%.
So you're talking about fact-checking and fake news and all these things.
That is important because at the end of the day, I think a lot of what is brewing in terms of what you were stating in terms of white supremacy and racism and fascism, it comes with also people not bringing facts to the table. Mm. So people spreading what is inherently lies.
Mm. Yeah, but there's no doubt about it. And that's why old-fashioned journalism rather than spoutings online need to be kind of at a premium at the moment in society, in our history. I think it's not too grandiose a thing to say. Why did you call the guards this weekend?
I started getting some calls. So this is the thing. I've been told a lot this week. I've been called every name under the sun, literally. I really hope my daughter doesn't
have you read
have
you been called teacher, so. Have you been called everything, Hazel?
I've been called everything that rhymes from... that goes from just your average witch and the other one that rhymes with witch to something that rhymes with James Blunt. So and being told everything to go back to where I came from, some hellhole, according to some people. Mm. Fur House is not a hellhole, I have you know. Mm-hmm. So, but well, they were referring to China.
Of course.
And everything under the sun, and it came in floods. And the thing is, through this all, everyone kept on saying, oh, stop playing the victim. I'm not. At no point did I say, oh, woe is me. At every point did I say, this is not on, because at the end of the day, I'm not the only one experiencing this. A lot of various groups who have protested against what is being said on the streets around Ireland, and especially in around Google, is that you can't incite hate like this. You shouldn't be able to incite hate like this. And there's a lot of people working to try to counter mistruths. But for me, what had happened was, after the messages, I kind of thought, well, you know, it's
that
messages.
Happens.
It happens, you know. So it's coming in by the bucket loads, but, you know, it's fine. But then what happened was then the phone call. The first phone call, I was at home with my little one and picked it up because my constituents call me from private numbers all the time. So picked it up and there was just heavy breathing on the call. And I thought, it's one of those. So I thought, that's fine. But then by the sixth phone call, I kind of realized, you know what? This is actually just not cool. So, like, never mind me being subjected to it. Anyone
how old is
be
your
subjected
child,
to this.
Alex?
She's close to two now.
Right. So you're listening to heavy breathing calls one after the other, minding your child at home, being a public representative and being subject to what is essentially a racist attack. Okay. And you strike me as being quite stoical about it. I think somebody else might be more deeply affected by it. I think you've got a thicker skin than some, but there's only so much elephantine skin one can have before the penetration. You know, it's not easy to be taking all the slings and arrows all the time.
It's not, but again, as I said, it's not just me. Like what I saw on Saturday with the anti-hate group that was out marching was there's a lot of people, there's a lot of love there. So there was a lot of people, a lot of stewards, a lot of people volunteering to get this rally together on Saturday. And they went along and they danced and they sang and they kind of showed the great side of Ireland. So, and I have to say that the guys that organise the Speakers Unicorner, they're amazing. But it was the fact that they showed that there's a lot of love and there's a lot of unity in Ireland as well. And I felt that as well. A lot of people did send me also messages to say, listen, keep up the good work. And you balance that. You kind of go, you know what? It's really crappy. It's really just crap of people to make calls to your home or make calls to your number and to just be cowardly and breathe down the phone and send you these messages. But on the other side, there's a lot of love and there's a lot of unity in the country as well. So I think that makes the thick skin easier, easier to have. So, but no, it isn't easy. But then there's a lot of people in the same boat as well, is all I can say. And it's a question of when do we start saying this is causing harm to people?
Which is, I'm so happy you said that, because that is leads to my next question to you, which is this. And this is what I started our chat with a little bit earlier on, which is it wise of us as a broadcaster and you as a politician to be in some way giving oxygen to a very noisy, very angry bunch of people who are, you know, propagating pretty nasty things as per the comments you read about, you told us about, and the name calling, all that kind of thing? Or should they be shut down by simply ignoring them?
I don't think ignoring works anymore. I think it's funny. I was thinking about kind of different incidents of bullying. This is what it is, bullying. So when I was younger, and one of the things I realized when I was younger was when you grow up, it actually gets better. When you become an adult, people grow up and it becomes better. But what I've noticed, I know.
About that. I often say adults are just children with wrinkles.
It turns out it's really remarkable.
It's
true.
Yeah,
but what I've noticed in the last 5 years especially, is that it's growing. It is growing, be it because of issues happening in the US, be it of the leadership in US.
Around
the world or the UK.
Yeah.
This is happening in our own country. And it's actually, no matter how much we try to ignore it, it is there. One of the things I received, some of the messages I received were from people who said, oh, I used to live in Ireland, but I moved out because I experienced X, Y, Z. And right. I found that it was, it had heightened. And this is the issue we have, is that no matter how much we want to bury our head in the sand, it is happening. Mm. So yes, to some degree, if you starve certain conversations of oxygen, you may think it dies. But especially with various platforms these days, they don't die. They actually rally more together.
I agree with you. And I think we've got to a point, as we were talking about, this isn't just about a national conversation. It's an international one where you have race being a conversation in so many countries around the world.
Mm-hmm.
You have people with questionable attitudes to race and the question of race becoming leaders of various nations around the world.
Yes.
And you're right. I think I agree with you that, and that's why we're here today in some ways, is because these people, and I'm talking about racist people, who are in the shadows, they're just heading out of the shadows a little into the hinterland.
Yes.
And then they come closer. And suddenly, before you know it, they're a councillor, and then they're a TD, and they're Taoiseach. You know? But I think we've been very fortunate politically in this country that I don't think there's a political party in the Irish system with a racist in bone in their bodies.
Currently not.
I think, I mean, political party.
Yes.
Well, we could get into personalities a bit, but we're not going to do that today. But that's for another conversation. But let me give you a little flavour of the text coming in. Hazel Chew joins us this morning, if you're just joining us, Green Party councillor. Great to hear Hazel on the radio. I'm not a fan of the Green Party policies, but I will fight to the death for her to air her opinions. Irish woman. Another one says, Hazel is a great role model for Irish women today, for her highlighting of the rampant racism in Ireland is much needed. So well done, Hazel. Sending much love and best wishes to Hazel Chew from East Clare. I hope she knows that there are a lot of people whom she will never know who are standing with her. Another says, from Jones, says Twitter can be absolutely vicious, and through it, Hazel is exposing herself to terrible hurt. Has she? Would she close her account? Want to answer that?
Will I close my account?
Yep.
Absolutely not. So
that's a defeat, is it?
Well, it's not even defeat. It's I've been mandated to support my constituents. I do that via Twitter. There's a lot of queries that come through Twitter and also in various forms. And I guess you're right in saying that it is defeat, because at the end of the day, why do I need to go and hide and shut down?
Yeah. No, and you're a public servant as opposed to a public figure, which is different in that you have to probably be there for the people to ask you these things.
Exactly.
All right. Peter Myrtle, good morning. Peter says, great to hear, listen to Hazel Chew speaking against the far right and their very active hate campaign across the country. Ignore this and it will thrive. And well, that's a very good point Peter makes, that if we ignore it, it thrives, and then they probably feel they're ignoring us and therefore we need to get bigger and multiply, and maybe there's something in that. Do they deserve freedom of speech? I mean, should people who are they wouldn't call themselves racist, but they'd call themselves that, they'd say they have problems with immigration, even if you're born in the Rotunda, you know, they don't seem to get that bit.
This is an issue I had to square with myself over the weekend week, and I'm sure yourselves have debate here in as a media outlet.
Yeah.
It's the case that when it's a case of censoring one freedom to act. So, and this is why I said at the beginning that we all have liberty and freedom to act, but we have to make sure that it doesn't cause harm on others. So, and part of it is, and all I guess in some way our speech is curtailed as well, if you look at how we have defamation. So if we look at how we have a right to privacy. So there are certain restrictions that we have, or we already have. But what we also need to do is protect what we have as a community. So what I saw on Saturday was there were at one point Nazi salutes, so which I found shocking. And
that is really extraordinary to think of a Nazi salute on the streets of Dublin in 2019.
Exactly. And when the other our side argued that it was just a plant by the lefties, it was one person. Then I saw about 2-3 more photos of different people doing it, and you're there going, oh my God, okay. So how is this okay? So how, and you're talking about a salute that was associated to a huge amount of harm. So again, it's back to that whole, yes, we do have freedoms and we should protect those freedoms, but they cannot cause harm to people.
God, I'm flabbergasted to hear that there was Nazi salutes.
It's funny. It's online. There's a big debate online about, are they planters? Are they not? But, you know, you may call one planter, but then there was like 3-4 of them. So, is that okay?
Ryan and Hazel at Augustus says it's absolutely important to call this out and discuss it with people experiencing this new generation of racism. It's all too easy to think that it's just in the United States and not here. We have the legacy of the North, and many of these fringe racists went for election recently, and that is an equality studies student called Augusta. Thank you. Ita in Sword says Hazel is amazing. She's right on to raise this dreadful topic. There's one easy way to challenge these angry, small-minded cowards, and that is to take away their anonymity and expose and find them. Dara says, listening with interest, I have some experience working with migrant parents, and from this experience I believe that there is also a rhetoric around language. Migrant and refugee are used in the same context by those who don't know any better, and this doesn't do anyone any good. Loaded words, says another, that have lost all meaning, totally fire people up Your great, eloquent guest this morning from another text to 551. So what next? I mean, I don't know what the hate crime legislation is like in this country. I mean, when I was watching with interest the sadness, the shootings last week,
yes,
which were, some say, inspired by insightful language about invasions, and that word invasion came up in the shooter's manifesto that he put on before he went in and shot up the mall. You know, it is something that we need to be, I suppose, aware of.
We do. And currently the Incitement of Hatred Act, there is an incitement prohibition of incitement to hatred, I think it's called. Correct me if I'm wrong, one of your listeners can do that. But there's only been 5 cases of fines within convictions and fines within that, and that sitting, I think it should be hard to prove. It is the law in this regard should be hard, because at the end of the day, we don't want to take people's freedoms away.
Is somebody doing a Nazi salute in Dublin? Is that an illegal act in this country? I don't know the answer. I'd be curious.
No,
if some
but it is in Germany. So it is in Germany
for obvious reasons. But
so I think we need to look at these things. But I guess it's not something for you and I to discuss right now. It's a wider conversation, and it comes back to my whole point that we do need wider conversations on these. We need to raise awareness on this and debate them factually, because at the end of the day, you see what happened in the States when people with very big microphones start sprouting a whole load of hate, start coming out with mistruths and lies. You have followings. And this is also what we saw, we've been seeing here, is that when people have microphones and start coming out with hate towards all minorities, you have a following, like people with Nazi salutes. So we need to protect against that.
We will. You're getting an awful lot of support here.
Thank you.
I can't tell you. We'll tell you later. But just people are appreciative that you've got the conversation not started, but certainly fired up. And it's important. And maybe it's something the Late Late Show might look at in the autumn when we come back to keep the conversation going. Because it's, I think children need to be listening to this. I'm glad they're off school today, because it's important. So many children from around the world, new Irish, older Irish, joining us now, and it's important that they're respected.
And this is the thing. I know, I remember something you said on our last meeting, is that there are Irish people around the world, and we're very proud of that. And we need to be proud of the Irish people in this country, no matter where they came from. And I really want things like posting kids' photos online to show that they're different to stop. That really has to stop. We can do it together, by the sounds of things. A lot of your listeners are very supportive. So it's amazing to feel that. But it's also, we need to understand that there is hate, it is rising, and we need to do something about it.
Well said. Green Party Councillor Hazel Chudon, hopefully you can get down to business and get on with your job as a councillor.
Of course you are.
It's a swerve, but it's an important conversation. We appreciate you coming in to talk to us about that this morning. At the time now, it's 8:58. Now, let's say hello to a nice person, though, and that's Sinead. Good morning, Sinead.
Good morning, Ryan.
It's nice to talk to you.
And you too. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's nice to be back. You wrote us an email that explains your situation. Can we ask you what age group you are?
I'm 38.
And in your early 20s, you had an illness.
Yes.
Which was
a brain tumour.
You removed that brain tumour.
Yes, it was non-cancerous, and
good.
They removed it. And yeah, I recovered and all good.
Good. And since then, how has life been for you in terms of, you know, life in the universe, working, relationships, all these sorts of things that we do?
Well, I suppose, after the first tumour, it wasn't cancerous. They removed it. I had a bit of recovery. And then I went on to travel. I spent 3 years abroad. I suppose I was hitting nearly 30, so I used the Australian visa, because I think at the time I was going, you needed to use it before you were 30. So went to Australia, went to Thailand. So I did loads of stuff after they removed that tumour.
Good.
And then I came home from travelling. I was away 3 years, came home from travelling and started a degree in UCD, kind of by distance. And then unfortunately in 2017 the tumour had reoccurred, and this time it wasn't as pleasant as the one before, so it was cancerous. And I had to have a lot of radiotherapy and a lot of chemotherapy, yes, which I have done. So, yeah.
Okay. And where are you at in terms of the tumour, the cancer? What is the diagnosis or prognosis?
Yeah, so where am I at? Yeah. I'd like to know that myself as well, but I don't really know. So I suppose I've had the maximum amount of radiotherapy. I've had a bit of chemo. My next option is more chemo, and I just don't really want to go down that road. Like, I mean, it was hard to do the radiotherapy the first time round. I had the maximum that you can have. I had a bit of chemo to go with that. Then I had some stable tumours for a while, and I was doing good. And then I had bad tumours, and so it's rare, and it's basically not good. They can't give me a time length. I mean, I suppose they want me to have more chemo, and I don't want to do that. Like, I mean, I don't have a partner. I don't have family.
You don't have family?
Pardon?
You don't have family?
No, like as in I don't have
You don't
kids
have kids and so on.
I understand. No, I have a great family.
Oh, God. No. Oh, God. Okay. but what I suppose, what's so striking about the email that you sent us was that you're curious about what?
Well, I went for lunch recently with somebody that I met.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were just kind of chatting, and I was talking about, I suppose, being terminally ill and the dating scene. And I said, God, like, I mean, it's hard anyway as you get older, because most people are paired off, or, you know, it's difficult, you know, when you get into your 30s and you're trying to find a partner, or you want to find a partner. So, yeah, we thought this is what we were discussing. Mm. She was recently divorced, lovely woman, very attractive. And so this was this discussion, and she said to me, I know how you feel, because I have MS. And I thought, God, this is not something that people discuss. Like, people are afraid of talking about death. And then as well, I suppose it really changes things. Like,
of course, you know, of course it does. You at the start of your treatment, you met a guy, you were queuing for a gig, and you met a guy and you went on a date. Is that right?
Yes. And I think we went on one or two dates.
Oh, good. But in the course of time, what was happening?
Well, I mean, I lost my hair, and then I had met him, I think, with hair, and then quickly lost my hair. And I think the next time I was meeting him was the first day I got my wig. And, you know, I happened to be in, I think it was Rohini or somewhere, like I was by the sea, and I was thinking, oh my God, I have my wig. You know, I wasn't secure with the wig yet. And yeah, it was just awkward. And I'm sure it was awkward for him as well.
And well, it could be awkward for some, and others might handle it differently. How did he handle it?
I suppose I was so caught up in what I was thinking that I probably wasn't thinking much about what he was thinking. You know, you kind of have this, verbal diarrhea in your own head, and just you're so insecure about it. But I suppose it's just difficult. I mean, difficult for you as a person with the wig, and then difficult for the person who's sitting there with you.
Did you see him again?
I did see him again, and I think I was starting, or had I started treatment, I just wasn't feeling great at the time. So, I mean, I don't blame the guy for kind of going, oh, this is a bit too much for me.
I can imagine. And you know, that's why. But are you still interested, Sinead, in dating?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm not dead yet.
No, of course that. I know that. But when you talk about the treatments or being unwell, are you jaded or too wrecked, or do you just want to get on with your life?
No, well, I mean, it's not a priority to meet somebody, but I mean, I was away, I travelled for 3 years, and like, some things are better shared. So
yeah.
I mean, I actually, if I don't meet somebody, that's absolutely fine. But I suppose it's a weird thing for somebody as well. Like, so if you meet somebody and they have a terminal illness, are you going to get involved with them?
Well, that is the question.
That is the question.
That is the question, Sinead. And here's another question for you. Yeah. At what point do you tell the person that you meet, this is where you're at?
That is the question, Ryan. I mean, like, I think at the moment I have chosen not to take any more chemotherapy because I was absolutely in bits. At the moment I'm living a pretty normal life and have, I mean, I don't have the energy that I did have, but I mean, I have a lot to give. I think I'm a fun person to be with. It would be nice to travel the Atlantic Way on Ryan's recommendations.
Do you, I'm just curious to know, like, if you did meet somebody and they said, yeah, and they really liked you and they just liked your personality, they liked who you were. They said, geez, I'd love to go on the Wide Atlantic Way with you. It sounded like great fun. We'd have a laugh. Do you say, okay, listen, that's great, but before we do anything else, there's something you need to know? Or do you just roll and let it come out in a more natural way? Do you have thoughts on that?
Well, that's the question, Ryan. Like, yeah. I met somebody recently who said that they had, we were discussing this, they said they had MS. So we were like, what do you do? Like, I mean, I don't know how I would feel if I met somebody. And I suppose, you know, like, do you keep it to yourself until you think, okay, there's longevity here, I need to be honest with the person? Or, you know, it's a conundrum that I've never heard people speak about. I mean, people are not good about speaking about death.
Or illness generally, you know.
Yeah, I love to joke about it, you know, but most people are not comfortable with you joking about it. You know, like, I'll say things like, I'm not dead yet, or, you know, I mean, and I think it's funny. Like, you know, you have to just get on with it. Like,
what if somebody fell in love with you?
Good for them.
knowing that, you know, there's possibly a finite nature to it all, and as it is with all of us, as we know, but that they'd be too sad or too upset for you, or them, or for you, plural.
Well, you see, that's the thing. Like, are you going to put somebody through that? Like, as well, for me, like, I'm thinking, yeah, I'd love to have somebody to, like, go on hikes with and walk the dog with. And
but there's no putting somebody through it if it's love.
Yeah, but how, I mean, can you as a person get past that kind of barrier? Like, you know, when you meet somebody, like, do you keep it to yourself that you have a terminal illness? Or, you know, that's the question that I don't know the answer to.
That's why you wrote to us.
Pardon?
That's why you wrote to us.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
To say, what?
it's just one of those questions. Like,
it is. Yeah, it is. It's such a conundrum.
For people to ponder. Like, yeah. I mean, I actually, as a, like, if I was on the other side, I would ponder that as well. Like, you know. But I suppose just, like, it kind of, yeah, you're kind of wondering as, like, I mean, I'm doing well at the moment and I have a love for life and, you know, I want to do things and I feel motivated and I want to make the best out of whatever I have left.
Yeah.
But, you know, is there anyone out there that's going to want to take that challenge on board, you know?
There are, yeah, of course, there's always got to be a way. There's always going to be somebody who's right for you, you would hope.
Well, I don't believe in, like, Mr. Right. I believe in just, I suppose, a commonality and, you know, I just, yeah, and like there's so much, life has so much to offer. And I suppose in getting sick now and not working, it has allowed me to do so many things. And, like, I feel like it's given me the chance. Like, I've so many insights now into life. I wish I could go back with the knowledge that I have now to live again and do all these different things, you know. And I suppose I just have a different look on life now to maybe your average Joe Soap. I mean, like, I would have been saving for a deposit for a house and just doing all those things that people in the rat race are doing. And now I'm not doing that. Like, I'm not saving. I'm spending that money. I'm wearing my nice perfume every day and, get those dresses or get those clothes out of the wardrobe and just enjoy.
So you would do things differently if you could. You'd go back and have take the road that's marked fun rather than safe.
Well, not even fun, but just I think it's slow living and just take the time. I mean, I hate the way the word mindfulness is bandied around, but I mean, I spent time in Australia and I was in a Buddhist centre for 12 weeks and I suppose I was being taught about mindfulness before it arrived over here, but I suppose when it came here, it became very, very, I don't know what's the right word to use,
sure.
But people bandy it around like, oh, we need to be mindful. But I mean, if you delve into what mindfulness is, I mean, it's very poignant and it's very worthwhile. I mean, if you can find something, it might be hoovering, it might be, you know, like I'm doing a lot of craft now that I'm not working, and those kind of things are just amazing for the mind and being given the opportunity to do those things.
So where to from here, Sinead?
Well, I have been crafting away, and so
good.
I hope to go online. I'm not a techie, but I hope to go online, and I've been doing a bit of pyrography, so wood burning, and yeah, so my plan is to, yeah, try and, you know, get out there with my craft stuff and that, you know, and if I meet, I would like to meet somebody, but yeah, I don't know where that's going to happen. But yeah, not a priority. But
you're very eloquent and articulate in the way you've described and posed that question. So let us have a think about it all and ponder, to use your word, and think about it and see what people say. Stay tuned.
Okay. Well, can I just I want to give a recommendation to a book that I've read.
Sure.
Which I just I've told as many people as I can about it, but it's called The Wonder Box by Roman. K-R-Z-N-A-R-I-C, however you pronounce that.
Mm-hmm.
But it goes through, like, it's kind of little vignettes of how different things have developed over time. And, you know, it talks about love and it talks about time. And I found it very insightful about how we are trying now to find love, all of the different types of love, all in the one person. And it just goes into like how there is different types of love, and it's an insight into kind of understanding more about love, and then time, how we've become slaves to time.
Well, that's a pressing issue. Well, I'm going to pick that up as soon as I can and revert back to you. Sinead, thank you for your time today. We'll keep an eye on you.
Thank you, Ryan.
And thank you so much for getting in touch with us. Appreciate
it. Take care.
Bye. Thank you so much. That's Sinead joining us. Sinead Carroll joining us on the phone there. Quite the conundrum. That's all I can say about that. But as the texts say, I think Sinead's clarity and courage are so impressive. Super vet Noel Fitzpatrick, good morning.
Good morning, my friend. How are you?
It's so good to it's always good to talk to you. But here we are. I'm particularly happy because you're so busy at the moment with Animal Rescue Live. I was watching you last night. You're a busy man. What's happening?
I'm just learning all I know from you, Ryan. You know, you told me, do live TV, my friend. Do live TV. So that's what I'm doing. Trying to save all the dogs and cats and chickens and rabbits and alpacas and donkeys in the land.
So you're trying to rehome as many animals from rescue shelters all over the UK. It's an intriguing prospect. Where did it come from and why are you involved?
Well, we did it nearly 2 years ago now in Newcastle.
Yeah.
And it was just the fact that I was getting so many animals come into the practice that had been rescued or needed rescue, and a lot of animals come from other countries into the UK to be rescued or are taken on by very well-meaning individuals, and there just isn't an awareness out there of the needs of most of the rescue centres being charities, and most of them needing volunteers, most of them needing people to adopt or foster pets, most of them needing education, actually, that these animals are not—they're not rejects. You know, we've had dogs that go into the police force from rescue centres. We've had dogs that help out dementia sufferers from rescue centres. And I wanted to get the message across that, you know, society is very disposable. We chuck away everything. And these animals are not misfits. They're just maybe a bit misunderstood, but certainly they've fallen on hard times. And hey, look, a lot of people fall on hard times. And sure. I think it's a call out to social responsibility to look after that.
Isn't it interesting how you get this massive response? If we could apply a bit of the generosity and kindness that people can show to dispossessed animals and add it to that approach to humans. In other words, you always talk about the humanimal approach. It would be kind of a better world.
Well, that's, in fact, my whole thrust now for the next couple of years is exactly that. I think we're in a very dangerous place in society right now. We've forgotten how to look after each other. We've forgotten what that kind of societal interpersonal love looks like. And we experience that all the time with animals because they don't judge us. They're not racist. They're not biased. They're not prejudiced. And we are all of that sometimes. And I think that if we can do this with animals and show a good example out there, I think that hopefully is redemptive. Hopefully it brings some hope to people and they'll see an animal who was, you know, mistreated maybe. We had a pony whose tail was chopped off. We had a horse covered in maggots or a cat that's fallen on hard times and treated very badly. If we take responsibility for that, maybe there's part of our souls that looks at that and says, you know what, come on. Come on, we could do better than this.
I saw a pony just like you described, maggots and matted and mottled on the news in RTE not too long ago. It just came up, flashed up. And the question I was asking myself, and you must ask yourself this a lot, Noel, is how can a human being wake up in the morning and look at that creature and think, yeah, I'm going to live the rest of my day and enjoy it and be normal?
It's extraordinary.
Isn't it?
The capacity of human beings for cruelty and also just for ignoring things, for ignorance, is extraordinary and never ceases to amaze me. I mean, you know, I grew up in a rural community in Ireland and I'm very proud of where I've come from, but I've been through all kinds of observations on animals globally, everything from the canine meat trade in, you know, places like Korea right through to really bad puppy farming situations, which we're going to deal with in this show. And man's capacity for cruelty and corruption and callousness, the three C's that I hate, is extraordinary. And unless enough good people, as a great Irish person once said, unless enough good people don't do enough, then the world turns into a bad place. So we can't just stand by and say, oh, that, you know, that doesn't matter. It's just, how many times have I heard it's just a dog, it's just a cat? Well, hang on a minute.
Yeah.
If you show a little kindness, just a tiny little ray of light there, how much better would the world be today?
You know, the puppy farms you mentioned there, that's tomorrow night, I think you're going to be touching on that subject.
I think Thursday.
Yeah, and did you get inside a cage of puppies? Is that part of what you're going to do?
Well, I just thought, look, the best way to bring this to life for people, and I didn't want to do it in an anthropomorphic way. I didn't want to do it by imbuing human feelings on the canine condition. But there's hundreds of thousands of puppies that are sold every year, and there's tens of thousands of them that come from puppy farms. And some of these dogs, people pay top dollar, and they just fall in love with the picture on the internet, and they just have no idea. You know, the puppies are taken from Wales or Ireland or somewhere else across the United Kingdom, and they're shipped to a semi-detached house that looks fairly respectable with a mother that's made up, and the puppies are there, and the people walk in unsuspecting, say, oh, is that the mother? Oh, yeah, it is, and have these puppies, and give us 500 quid, and off you go. It's terrible. And the puppies may be living in awful conditions. And look, I just don't like corruption. I don't like cruelty. I don't like callousness, as I said before. And I thought the best way to try and shine a light on this is to go into the dark. And so it was illegal, actually, to go in a cage without a harness because you can't drive in a car without a seatbelt on the motorway. So I went into the back of a darkened van, as a puppy would be, and got strapped into a cage to travel as that puppy would from its bad situation into another bad situation before some unsuspecting person then says, oh, I'll give that puppy a home. But what they don't realize is they're funding the bad situation.
Yeah.
So I wanted to shine a light on that. There's a lot of criminality that goes on behind that. I'm doing quite a lot of work with knife crime and with, you know, drug crime and all of that stuff. And I think that if I can do my little bit as a vet looking after animals, and a lot of the people actually involved in crime have dogs, if I can maybe, just maybe, shine a light and say, you know what, there's a better way to make a living than this. We shouldn't be supporting this industry that's often really cruel. And I felt the best way to do that was to get the audience to travel with me in the van and show what these puppies went through.
Yeah, it makes great sense. On a lighter note, Noel, when you were on Good Morning Britain and you let the dog lick your face and people went into conniptions about whether or not that was a good thing or if it was a disgusting thing to do. And I've been in houses and I see people and I meet people and the humans' tongues are sometimes out as well and they're all at it, you know, it's all tongues with the dogs and so on. It's not just the face. So where are we on dogs licking and, you know, connecting with humans on the face and maybe in the mouth?
It's so funny how media, and I deign to you know, categorise you in the same
place.
Media, it has to be entertaining. And that's really important, I think. You know, when we do the show, we can't get serious messages across. It doesn't want to be entertainment, but it needs to be entertaining.
And
in fact, last night, we had a dog lick me on the face, just went mental on the set while I was introducing the dog and showing behaviour. But here's the thing. Look, I'm a veterinary surgeon.
Yes.
And therefore, I deal with people are like, oh, that's disgusting, and there's loads of bugs and everything else. And there's no question that bugs in animals can affect bugs in humans. I mean, you know that one of my life's missions is to explain that bacterial resistance comes from antibiotic overprescription, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. But on a funny note, the reason this has gained press traction is because some celebrities have appeared on whatever their platform on social media is and had dogs lick their face. Look, I am all for love. I don't think that you should be sharing bugs with the tongue contact, but I do think that if you're sharing that love and you wash your face and hands, come on, get over yourselves. We need to show a little bit of love. And if a puppy licks you on the face, no matter how bad your divorce is or how bad your boss is or how bad your day is, why would we not want it?
Take the licking and be gone. That's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Lap it up, my friend. Lap it up. That's the love of your life. You deserve it.
Much better. Have you been to any good gigs this summer? I know you love your music. Have you had time or anything?
I love it. Yeah. I got to see the Eagles and I got to see the Who this summer. It was brilliant. I went to Wembley Stadium.
Wow.
But you'll love this because it was a brilliant quote from the Eagles. They walked out on stage like they looked 107.
Yeah.
And they had a couple of young guys among them. It was brilliant and very pertinent to us, Ryan, because it's what we'd like to bequeath. The dude stood up there and he looked like he'd just been preserved in time. And he said, you know what? We may be dinosaurs, but we sure have left fairly big footprints.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, of course you have, my friend.
Yeah, non-carbon as well.
And that's the whole point. That's what we'd like to do, isn't it? Leave some kind of legacy.
That's for sure.
So that, you know, we can make the world a little bit happier.
And you loved the Who was a good gig. You were happy with the lads.
Oh, fabulous. They had an orchestra it was amazing because they train another orchestra, not train, but blend in with another orchestra in every city they went to. Extraordinary.
Yeah,
Roger was on form. Pete was on form. It was brilliant.
Wonderful.
Absolutely fantastic.
And
that's what we do. Bring joy into people's lives in with music and with animals and anything else that's a good thing. You do it with radio.
I was watching you with the you know, the little kittens last night. I could hear them. And I saw you loving, enjoying the live TV experience. It's different to your normal world.
You know what? It's a real, Steve Jones has been incredibly generous with me because, as you well know, people don't realize that you have to go through that three or four different times because people need to know where they're supposed to be. And I'm going now to do tonight's show because we need to, you know, what animals are going to come on? Are we going to have a snake wrap around Steve's body? I certainly hope so. And it's great fun, you know, because a lot of spontaneous stuff happens that you don't, you know, and you block it out and you do your best. But what it is the immediacy of it. And I think the call to arms, and our call to arms this week is Dave, which is a word I thought up last week, and it's a D for donate, A for adopt, V for volunteer, and E for educate.
Nice.
And I think if we can bring Dave into our lives this week, Animal Rescue Live will have done a good job.
Back to the studio with you, Noel, or to the set even. It's great, as always, great to talk to you, and we'll see you hopefully here or there very, very soon.
We will indeed. Thanks, my friend.
Mind
care.
Yourself. Thanks a million, Noel. Noel Fitzpatrick there, super vet, super guy. He is super in every way, says Kathleen. And what a beautiful heart he has. I love him, says another text. 51551. And he's just like that, by the way, in real life. If you were wondering, he's just one of the good ones. That's the truth of the matter. It's 25 to 10 o'clock. At 22 minutes past 9, the text number 51551, email ryan@rte.ie. I want to introduce you now to my next guest. His name is Chris Donovan. Chris, you're very welcome to the programme. Nice to meet you.
Thanks very much for having me here.
You, when you were a child, did you dream of being in the Irish Defence Forces, or did it come to you later? When did the ambition arise?
Well, I sort of knew I always wanted to be a soldier. I kind of had this real grow for the outdoors, and I joined the Cub Scouts in Ballymun when I was like 7 or so.
That's a good start, isn't it?
And kind of the ethos was kind of similar, you know, like outdoor stuff. And that kind of appealed to me. So I sort of knew that I was going to gravitate towards that sort of a career.
And you did. You joined the army.
At the first opportunity, yeah.
How old were you?
I was just gone 18.
Great. And what was your initial take on the place and the uniforms and the routine and so on?
I was kind of familiar with it because I had kind of cheated a little bit and joined the FCA as an underage soldier, you know, and I had an inkling that I would enjoy it. I hadn't taken that progression to the Permanent Defence Forces, and I did. I found that it suited my personality, and I like to be fit, so.
So it worked out in that regard.
It worked for me.
All right, and tell me, you were there for how long before they sent you across to the Lebanon?
I joined in August 83, and in October 84 I was deployed to Lebanon.
Right, and do you remember well that first day landing?
We landed in Tel Aviv, which in Israel, and it's a very modern, advanced society. And you progress through Israel on trucks, and then you cross the border at Russian Ikra into Lebanon, and it's going back to the land that time forgot.
Is it really?
You didn't see a wall that didn't have a bullet hole in it or a tank round in it. You didn't see anything that wasn't destroyed until you came to the UN camp, which was a place called Nakura, where you kind of changed and got fed, and onward transport to the battalion area up in the hills. And you go from Nakura to the hills, it's like going from Fox Rock to Ballymun. It was an eye-opener, you know, your very first day in the place, and it's destruction.
In what sense?
Everything around you is destroyed. Everything's got holes in it. The roads are potholed, and the more you spend on time spent on the roads, the more you realise that the potholes are not there because of road wear.
Yeah.
They're there because of ordnance.
Were you nervous?
No, it was an adventure. Yeah. I was excited.
So you were confident with what you were going into. You'd had your training, so you were ready for it.
Oh, absolutely. I thought it was, yeah.
You say you thought you were. What confronted you? There was one particular incident, I think, that changed your life in many regards.
Yeah, I was a member of the weapons platoon, which provides heavy weapons support to the infantry platoons within the company. And we were deployed to a place called Scribbin. But another platoon were having a hard time in a village called Yatar. So we were seconded from our place to theirs. And the Israelis at the time would surround a village if they thought that there were
suspects
and militia in it, and extract all the males over 14.
And what would they do with them? Just take them all out for questioning? Or?
Well, they'd take them, remove them from the village, interrogate them and let them go over a period of days. But they used to use these proxy militia called Lewis, Locals Armed and Uniformed by Israel, or DFF, De Facto Forces, essentially to do their dirty work. And they had this particular man whose name was Ali Khalil, and he was known as a kind of a gruesome kind of a character, you know. And one of our armour personnel carriers had managed to break the cordon, and we were detached as ground element, and we were a little way behind the APC, maybe 70, 80 metres. And there was this family we used to give bread to. We got this bread and it was rock hard, you couldn't eat the stuff. So we used to give it to them, and the father had been killed, or he was absent for some reason, but I think he had been killed. So there were a mother and two daughters, a little slow in the head, if you know what I mean. But they were nice. So we used to give them this, and they subsisted on it. They'd grow their vegetables, whatever, in the garden, but they'd get the bread and they'd leave it setting in milk and then dip it in honey and eat it, you know, milk and honey.
And would you have got to know this family over the course of time?
I'd only been there a couple of days.
Yeah, so you
at this time. So, but I knew we didn't eat this bread, so we gave it to them.
Sure.
Like, it's part of the humanitarian thing, and Irish people generally care for the underdogs.
Yeah.
But these people had nothing. But this man, anyway, there was a young one there. She was 15. Her name was Mona Karani. And she was picking aubergines. And, sorry, get a little. it's upset with this.
Yeah, because you were how old at this time?
I was, I think it was 19.
19. So you were kind of like a boy yourself.
I was a pup.
And this girl you're describing was how old?
Yeah, she was 15.
And she was picking aubergines.
Yeah. But Khalil walked straight past the front of the APC and took a pistol out and shot her in the head. And you're not that far away. And you can see the effects. Because you're a soldier, you know the effects of firearms on the human body. And her, he shot her in the back of the head and she dropped like a stone. And
I'm giving you time to breathe and tell the story in your own time, if that's okay. I don't want you to be uncomfortable, but you're describing the most brutal, callous execution of an innocent person.
He did it because he could do it, because he knew he had the protection. Rules and regulations are involved in the use of firearms. You can't fire until you're fired upon or to save someone else's life, if you think. But
you witnessed this execution. You were not too far away. What did you do? Did you go to her?
I went to shoot Khalil. But he dropped the pistol. I can't shoot an unarmed man.
He knew what he was doing.
He did play the rules. Turned around and he ran off. He ran down. He ran through the house, the family's house, down the wadi, and was collected and brought off by the Israelis.
And that's the end of that's the last you saw of him, I take it.
No, we've seen him several times after that. But the good news is he got he was taken away by persons unknown and executed a couple of years later.
Back to the scene of the crime, in every sense, what did you do in the immediate aftermath? I mean, you took your gun out to try and shoot this guy. He dropped his. He ran. Where did you go after this?
We ran to the back of the APC. The crew from the APC had already got out of the car and they were tending to the girl, but there was nothing they could do. I mean, the front of her head was essentially not there, you know. And they loaded her into the APC. We provided security because the Israelis, having heard the commotion, were rushing towards the area. And we wanted to get the family out of there because you just don't know what's going to happen. So we got the family back into the house, the mother and the other daughter. The APC withdrew because we had no armoured support. We had to withdraw with it. So we walked out with the APC. We walked, trot, ran. And the APC breached the cordon and took the young one back down to one of our checkpoints. I don't know what happened thereafter. We had to withdraw back to the platoon position.
Let me bring you home to Ireland after that tour of duty, if you wouldn't mind. And let me just get a sense of, let's say you're trying to have a beer in a pub with, you know, family members or friends or whatever. What's happening to you in your head?
See, essentially you have to understand that when you're deployed in a place like Lebanon, you're on edge all the time. You're at a heightened state of awareness because you just don't know when the next attack or when the next event is going to unfold, and you have to just completely be prepared. And you come from Lebanon at 10 o'clock in the morning and on the following afternoon, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you're free to do what you like. You have a month off. But you don't de-escalate. You are in that same state of mind. So when I would come home, and one of the things I used to do is go for a beer with my dad the next day.
Okay.
And
the day after you land home.
Yeah, that sort of thing. And okay. You go to the Towers pub in Ballymun, famous old watering hole. Yeah. Famous for lots of reasons. it was our local, but we'd go in there and I'd sit in the corner because I didn't have to deal with anyone approaching or anything approaching from behind or the two sides. I could concentrate on everything that was in front, and I would be very nervous. It was very hard to settle.
You were obviously very damaged, not damaged, probably a cruel word, an unfair word, but you were troubled by what you had seen. Were you getting flashbacks?
I suffered quite badly with it, you know, but you're 19, you're 20 and you think, yeah, it'll pass, you know, and you develop coping mechanisms to deal with it yourself.
Like what? What does that mean?
Well, you don't really talk about it with other people because you get told, grow up here, man up, sort of thing, you know. Well, yeah. It happens, you know, it's part of your job.
Yeah, what did you expect to join the army sort of thing?
Yeah, that sort of thing. But, you know, that's all well and good, but it doesn't diminish what's happening to you.
Of course it doesn't.
So you have to develop coping mechanisms. I turned to alcohol and... I didn't think about it at the time, but I just thought everyone else is doing it. Well, all my peers would do the same sort of thing. You know, you'd go for a few beers on a Wednesday when you got paid, and all of a sudden it would be Friday.
You'd just keep going.
Sort of, yeah.
To block out
everything.
Everything. Yeah. And by everything, are you talking about one incident or the life of a soldier?
No. In the early days in Lebanon, it was constant.
What was?
You would have incoming fire. You'd have. See, you have to understand that 90% of conflict is spent waiting for the 10%.
Yeah.
And you're always on edge. And when it happens, your consciousness, it sounds silly, your consciousness elevates to a state of readiness that you would never associate with yourself.
In the real world.
Yeah.
If you want to call it that. No, yeah. I do understand what you're saying. It makes great sense. You're living on your nerves.
Yeah. And it just becomes constant. You don't. When you come back, like a month after you come back, you've had a month of supposedly living like a civilian, but you're not. You're living like a soldier in a civilian world because you've got this stuff that just doesn't go away. This movie Saving Private Ryan came out.
Yeah.
And I'd arranged to meet a friend of mine. He said, you should go and see this. It's really good, you know. And I don't really do these things, but he's a good boy, you know. So I said, I'll tap along. When I went up to the cinema in Santry.
Yeah.
And he never turned up. He said, I'll go in anyway. So I went in, and at the opening scenes at Curaclo, it's just
stunning.
It wasn't the visual part of it. That was okay. It was realistic enough, but it was the sound of bullets hitting steel.
Yeah.
And I was transported from there back to an incident where that was the sound. That was the overriding sound of the incident. And I was there again, and I crawled out of that cinema. And the girl at the door just laughed and said, "What are you?" And I went, I couldn't even speak.
What was happening in your head and to your body watching that film?
I was shaking. I started to shake.
It's like a panic attack almost.
Yeah, I burst into tears and I couldn't stand. I had to crawl. I crawled out of the cinema on my hands and knees.
Did you?
Yeah, that's it. That's it. And I went across to the Swiss cottage and I took some permanent lodging in a beer glass. And that was just one of several ways of reacting to these kind of things, you know.
You decided that at some point, Chris, that it's time to end your life.
Yeah.
Not once but twice.
Mm-hmm.
What brought you to that brink?
I don't know. There's no single reason or there's possibly a combination of reasons, but I can't identify any particular thing. It just felt like I'd had enough.
Just accumulation of it all?
Pretty much, yeah.
The first time involved a gun?
Two of them.
What?
A rifle and a pistol.
And where were you?
I was in Lebanon. I was in a post in the hills, and it was a winter tour, and I was in my billet. It's a prefab, if you like. And I remember the wind is a constant factor there, and it's so cold in the winter. And the icicles in the winter were horizontal. And I was sitting down in the billet, and I had a pistol in my lap, and the pistol was cocked. It's ready for use. And I was looking up, and there's a white formica ceiling, if you like, and I couldn't see it. Just a big blue sky and a big yellow sun. And I said, if you're up there, he says, help me. I'm going down quicker than the Belgrano. I said, this is just not going to be my day. And I cocked the rifle. And in the prefabs, we had managed to source wood. We had to give ourselves a little bit of privacy in cubicles. And I remember cocking the rifle. And then the wall exploded. And a colleague came through and just shouted, what are you doing? You go shoot you. And he started to hit me. And the rifle left my hands. I don't remember directing myself to throw the rifle. Left my hands and bounced into the corner, and the pistol was already there, and I don't remember how that got there, but I remember this man shouting at me, calling me all sorts of idiots and punching me. And I said to myself, I remember clearly saying to myself, this is going to hurt, I think I'll just go to sleep. And I just went to sleep. I woke up the next day and I just said, thanks. And we never spoke about it again, and you know who he is, and thanks, pal.
Yeah, saved your life. You know, what's kind of telling about that story, Chris, in many ways, is that you never spoke about it again. There doesn't seem to be, in the telling your story in the Defence Forces in the 80s, much talk of, you know, what mental health, care, minding, that sort of thing. That just wasn't the done thing, is that right? Or am I putting words in your mouth?
It didn't exist.
Yeah. So did you talk to anyone? I mean, did you talk to your father with the beer, or did he say,
no.
You know, no?
No.
Did you want to?
No. No, why? I genuinely didn't. Because I didn't want to be... See, you have to understand, the Defence Forces, the military is a thing that operates on a system of honour and bravery and care for your colleagues. You've always got... You're always looking out for your colleagues, and they're always looking out for you. Mm-hmm. But at the time, to discuss something like this was just, it was seen as a weakness.
Yeah.
And in an organisation where toughness is a requirement,
yeah.
You didn't want to be seen as weak. And there was the other thing about career progression. If you identified to other people, if you turned around to other people and said, listen, I'm really having a hard time here, and it went up the chain, you never went any further.
What year did you leave the Defence Forces?
2007.
And why did you leave?
I just couldn't do any more because the uniform was burning me going on. I put the uniform on and felt like it was burning where I touched. I just had this horrible feeling and I couldn't justify it to myself anymore. So I left it.
Had you at any point... do you still have the uniform?
No. I left... When I left the Defence Force, when you leave, you're required to hand in all your kit.
But, I didn't know that.
But people don't. People hold on to bits that mean something to them. Like, I held on to my berry, and my UN berry, and my medals. I held on to a pair of boots. You can charge me CQ O'Neill if you wish. but that's all I kept.
Where are your medals now?
I don't know.
Why don't you know?
I think I kind of threw them away a bit.
Well, look.
I hid them.
Okay, you earned those medals serving this country.
Mm-hmm.
You should be extremely proud of those medals. I think, as a person who hasn't walked a centimetre in your shoes. So where are they?
They're in a box somewhere.
Yeah, you didn't throw them away, but you put them out of your mind.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So they're in a box somewhere. Would you consider trying to find those medals again sometime, maybe, and dusting them down, and maybe taking a little pride in them? And in yourself as a human being who served his country.
I'm extremely proud of myself. I'm extremely proud of what I've done and endured. And the mission... I went back to Lebanon 8 times because I didn't have a sense of mission completion. In the army, you train for mission completion.
And what did mission completion mean to you?
That I had done everything I could do to achieve what I set out to do.
And why did it take 8 visits?
Because I didn't have that feeling. Every time I went back, I wanted to see more improvements for the people there than there were. I didn't think I had done enough personally, so I went back to do more. I went back to do everything I could do to make their lives better, because that's what you do. And peacekeeping is not a soldier's job, but only soldiers can do it.
I want to go back, if I can, just for a moment, Chris, to the uniform. You handed that back, obviously. Was it with relief or was it with sadness?
It was grief. I handed it back with grief because I had an organisation that I had given my youth to, and I loved intensely. I loved my colleagues. I loved being a soldier. And I handed it back in. I meant I couldn't be a soldier. I physically and mentally couldn't be a soldier anymore. And it was like handing over a child. But I knew that if I was to stay there, I just wouldn't have. I wouldn't have survived it.
Post-traumatic stress disorder. It's an expression I seem to recall coming out first after the Falklands, funny enough. when it became a known thing and acknowledged thing. And then you could then bring it back to any war, Vietnam in particular, mm-hmm. and then back to World War II and into one and so on. Do you suffer from this?
Yes, I do.
Okay. And when was that given a diagnosis or...?
I had gone to the army psychiatrist for treatment and, well, for a voice. I didn't know about PTSD. I knew nothing about it. I didn't even know it existed. I just knew that I couldn't sleep, that I had nightmares and flashbacks and that I was having a hard time. So I went to essentially get a bit of counselling and let's just say it wasn't... It's stroke he, stroke the Defence Forces, were deficient completely in that regard.
And where are you now, do you think, in regard psychologically to the world and yourself?
See, I've had to accept that this is a part of me.
Okay.
This will never go away. It will never...
You're showing me the piece of tissue that you have pretty much mangled for the last half an hour in the course of this conversation, which probably explains...
Well, I've run out of fingernails.
You've run out of nails.
Sorry.
That's all right. What are you thinking?
Fight or flight.
Stick around and tell me what's on your mind.
Yeah, do you know, this thing is part of me now. It just doesn't go away. I have to learn. I've had to learn coping mechanisms. I've had to teach myself to walk away from things where I can be stressed.
Yes.
You know, and I'm a little stressed now.
Well, that's okay. I understand that. I'm
not going to walk away because you're a nice guy.
You're telling us. Here's what I'll say to you. I watched the Defence Forces families and friends marching in Air Square last 2 weeks ago on the news. And because the Defence Forces aren't allowed to do that, as you know, looking for better pay and conditions and so on. And I didn't really understand. I don't really understand what it's like to be in the Defence Force. I've never been to the Lebanon and I've never really got into your world. But the more I hear you speak, the more I think we're getting a little flavour of what it's like and what the conditions are. We always hear the UN peacekeepers and aren't they great? And they are. But there's more to it. There's more to it.
Every story has many facets. Media is one facet. Combat is another facet. Mm. Dealing with it is another facet. The humanitarian aspect is another facet. Mm. Irish soldiers go to Lebanon and to this day we support an orphanage in Timnin. Mm. And I remember being in that orphanage when Noel Dempsey was Minister of Defence and he came to visit and a man small in stature but a really good man. And we were shown kids how to play on playground apparatus, playground things, and he was there doing it with us. And the orphanage, we would fund the orphanage, we'd pay a little out of our wage. Over there.
The soldiers.
Yeah. And Christmas, we do a big party for the kids. And do you know, that was one thing we could do that would normalise a thing for us. You're bringing these kids some facet of normal, some degree of normality.
Sure.
And we were there for a thing called Operation Accountability, where the Israelis effectively depopulated the south of the country through force, through bomb attacks and airstrikes and artillery. And we had troops based in the orphanage with the big UN painted on the top in an effort to stop the Israeli shell in the orphanage.
Tell me about you now, Chris. What are you doing with yourself in life? Did you ever meet somebody else?
I met the wonderful Suzanne, who I hadn't seen in many, many years, and we're very happy. And
that's good. I'm glad to hear
living
that.
Life nicely.
Are you?
Yeah.
What are you reading there? You brought a book in with you. Is that just what you're reading waiting to come on today?
It's a war book
of all things.
Which, you know what it is? It requires a lot of concentration to get in because it's very, very technical.
Kampfgruppe Piper, The Race for the Muse by David Cook and Wayne Evans. This is Hitler's last great offensive.
It is, yeah.
Of all the things to be reading, given, you know what I mean? Given that you crawled out of Saving Private Ryan, you know, panicked.
Ironic, isn't it?
Isn't it?
Yeah, well, do you know what? It just kind of piqued my interest. It was a present.
Yeah.
And it's not normally the type of book I'd go for. I kind of like trash fiction, you know, like this Pulp Fiction kind of stuff. But I picked it up and I went, you know what, I'll just have a little look. And it's so detailed and it goes into so much. It analyses the thing to death.
Let me take some. You probably know Tom Clonan. He's a military expert, and he's been on to say, please tell Kieran that he, or at least I should say Chris, that he is incredibly brave to speak for us all and many who cannot speak. We all went to the to Lebanon. None of us came home the same, and we left part of ourselves behind. He says, thanks to you, we get a glimpse of our true selves. So respect a true brother in arms.
Thanks, Tom.
Another from David says, the untold story of the Defence Forces veterans, extraordinary interview. Please let everyone know, because people want to see this, letting the man tell a story, the story. If you have a veteran in your family or your friends, give them a hug. I think that's incredible. I'll read another one from Oliver. He said, my heart goes out to your guest. He has a heart of gold and genuinely cared for the people of Lebanon. Some have higher sensitivity in their DNA, and the world is a much better place for having them with us. He is a natural humanitarian. There's great respect for you.
Thank you.
I hope you know that. From me, standing here, sitting here across from you, and from the listeners listening to your story, my heart is broken for the trauma suffered by Chris this morning. Peacekeeping is difficult and horrendous, as well as brave and noble. It has a glorious side that you've been talking about as well. But you're with, did you say Suzanne?
Mm-hmm.
And what are you doing with yourself on a day to day? Are you working? Or have you got anything?
No, I'm. Let's just say I'm retired.
Okay. Are you off the sauce?
Pretty much. Yeah.
Pretty much.
Occasionally, I'll have a bottle of Guinness, but.
But you're minding yourself.
It's very rare.
Okay. Okay. And then just another one from Hugh, who says, I'm listening and crying actually at the wonderful honesty and openness of that Irish soldier. I was that soldier in the Leb, and I now I understand more as a psychologist. We need to do more, and our country needs to appreciate more. And I wish him well. I definitely come away from our conversation appreciating the Defence Forces more, and trying to get an insight into the men and women in the uniform. It is amazing. Just another one says, your guest deserves such sympathy and appreciation for his career and his choice and for taking that path in life. He had the courage that so many of us would never have had in life. Now, Chris, I'm really pleased that you came to see us today.
I'm going to go off and have a whinge.
I bet you are. But you know what? You didn't fly. You fought. You fought in every sense in your life. And we appreciate you coming in to tell your story this morning. It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for your time. Mind yourself.
Thanks for having me here.
Chris Donovan, live in studio this Thursday morning. It's 10 to 10.